The stage is dark, but the conversation is just beginning.
Welcome back to the Utah Symphony, Utah Opera Ghostlight podcast, a behind-the-curtain look into the world of classical music and the artists who make it. I'm Carol Anderson.
And I'm Jeff Counts. As we record, Utah Opera is preparing to present Massenet's Thais, May 4th through 12th. We are doing the last of our opera prelude episodes of this season. We're very excited to talk about this piece with you, especially because Thais is one of those names that everybody knows, Carol, because of the famous Meditation for Solo Violin. But I doubt people know much about this opera. Do you think that speaks to a larger issue regarding French grand opera in American houses?
Well, first of all, I want to do the American politician thing and steer it to something I wanted to make sure I said.
Do that.
Which is what's particularly significant for us on, well, it's Thais is a significant title for us on many levels, but this is one of the final operas that was left over from COVID cancellations and pivoting. And so we are super excited. I was unexpectedly emotional on the first day of rehearsal, realizing that this had been something we'd been working on for 6 years, and we'd been waiting to have day one of rehearsal for a very long time, and it was 4 years delayed. So
I think you're making my point for me, because it was important to you back in 2020, and it's important still, because most companies just don't do a lot of this repertoire. French opera
right.
is missing from most houses.
And I want to say, and let's be specific, most American houses.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew that's what you meant, but I just wanted to say that for our listeners. Most companies in America, they do Carmen, they do Faust, they do maybe Romeo and Juliet if they're feeling particularly edgy. And or if they want to be really crazy, let's do the other opera by that Carmen dude, and let's do the Pearl Fishers. But there's just not a ton of opera that in French language that gets done. And I'm not really, I don't know if we can really unpack why that's so strange in this country, what it is about French. We even find it with American choruses. French is an overwhelming language to deal with sometimes in a way that Italian and German don't seem to be. And I want to make a real point that this is the first time that Utah Opera in its almost 50-year history has presented an opera by Jules Massenet.
That can't be true.
No, that's absolutely true. And it's
wow.
Not one of his most popular ones either, which is
right.
Particularly interesting. It's not Manon, it's not Werther, which are the two Massenet operas that get done most in this country.
Well, certainly Utah Opera is doing its part to try to correct some of this. I would say that, interestingly, in American opera houses, probably Poulenc Dialogue of the Carmelites is more frequently presented than works by Jules Massenet, which
is
strange to me.
Oh, yeah, we did forget that one, yes.
Well, it's also uncommon, but it's probably more common than works by Massenet. So since people don't know anything, Carol, about Thais, I'm making an assumption here. Can you take us through the synopsis? Who is Thais? Where is she on that operatic stereotype hierarchy of queen, witch, courtier, chambermaid?
Well, let's start with the historical, which is a little specious to begin with. She is a Catholic saint, Saint Thais of Alexandria. I discovered her feast day is October 8th. She was said to be a courtesan in Alexandria, and the monk Paphnutius came out of the desert near there. There was this whole thing in the early, I would say the early first millennium, after the death of Christ, where there was this trend of desert hermitage and communal living for religious men and women. So this monk, Paphnutius, comes out of the desert because he's had a vision that he has to save Thais. And so he goes to Thais, he goes to her opulent home, he interacts with her, and she agrees that she needs to change her life. And so she goes to the desert to join a community of nuns. And then he supposedly seals her up in a cell for 3 years where she has to just, they just pass food through a little hole. And then when she's done that penance, she comes out, she's purified. And then legendarily, she dies within about 2 weeks after coming
right,
out of
her
cell.
Right, she doesn't live much longer, like 15 days or something. Yeah.
Right. And there are some scholars that say that she is just kind of a metaphor, a parable that was created to educate, I guess, women in the Middle Ages about the dangers of being a sex worker and the danger for your soul. So that was kind of, that's the legendary story. It's happened in several iterations along the way, a play, some poetry, et cetera, et cetera. We get to the 19th century and Anatole France writes a novel about Thais, and he is very anti-religion, very anti-church, kind of just cynical about life. And so it's quite kind of a satirical, edgy, bitter kind of telling of this story. And that's what Massenet pulled for his immediate source material.
In the opera, Thais is a bit more of a libertine than the story you just told. She's harder to convince in the opera. Does that come from the Anatole France book?
You know, yes. And I will say the Anatole France book, I'm trying to remember back, because of course I read it in preparation back in 2020, and I'm trying to remember, but I feel like it's a little bit more strangely Paphnutius' story. And Paphnutius becomes, I think, Paphnus or something like that in the French version. And then his name in the opera is Athanael. It's almost more his story, just kind of because what happens in the opera, they take it quite a bit further. And Paphnutius is fighting his lust for Thais all along. And so eventually at the end of the opera, when Thais has found her religious fervor and she's on her deathbed, seeing the gates of heaven unfold, he's realizing that the woman he should have been with carnally all this time is now going to be forever out of his reach. So he loses his faith in the process of her finding it.
So they sort of pass each other on their way to and from this religious ideal. So highly religious, the story, highly...
Highly religious with Anatole France's anti-religion spin on it.
Exactly. So is the synopsis of the opera, does it match what you said in terms of the story of the saint? How does it differ?
It's mostly the same. And we never see her walled up in a little cell. It just, when we get the report of what she's been doing in the nun community, she's just been kind of hanging out, and the nuns have been impressed with her piety. And then of course she's on her deathbed, and that's kind of, we get a lot of that reported to us. We don't actually see that. We see the deathbed scene, but yeah, it's basically the story. We just get a lot more, because we have an opera chorus to work with, we get a little bit more licentiousness and a few more of this sort of epic party scenes, because the two big chorus scenes, one is at a fete at the house of Nicias, who's at that moment Thais's current lover. And then the second act big chorus scene is where the chorus is kind of in this drunken bacchanal trying to keep Thais from leaving with Athanael and going out to the desert. So they feel like she's a kind of a possession of theirs. Then they don't want Thais to leave Alexandria because they love hanging around with her and going to her parties.
Their stance of hers, but their stances on her change, both of them. The first gentleman, who is basically paying for her time and obsessed with her carnally, eventually concedes that she probably should turn towards the light, right?
Right.
And the other gentleman, who's taking her towards the light, eventually wishes he had known her in the flesh. They sort of pass each other as well, these two guys.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting that the agent of their escape from this mob is kind of enraged at the idea that Thais would leave Alexandria and leave them behind. And Nicias is the one who distracts them. He just throws money into the crowd.
That he had intended to give Thais, he throws to the crowd to distract them.
And they're able to make their escape
into
the desert.
You started digging into some of the things that are happening in the first two acts. Where does the famous moment I referenced earlier, the meditation, occur in this story? And what's happening around that? Everybody knows this as a beautiful melody, but what's the story in that particular moment?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of big instrumental interludes here, and most of them are accompanied in our production. And they are, it's said to be done in the libretto as well by... certain staging moments. For instance, there's a big interlude in Act One, which is the vision of that Athanael has of Thais that leads him to go to Alexandria. And so the meditation, the very famous piece, which is essentially the thing that comes up most when you try to Google Thais by Massenet, you don't get anything much about the opera. You get all these particularly violinists who have recorded this piece. It's just been played by everyone. And so that I was actually excited when I first saw Thais at the Metropolitan Opera to see how the meditation fit in, because I had also played it for violinists. It is in Act Two. So in the beginning of Act Two, Atanael comes and they have a conversation and he delivers his message. And she says, I'm not ready to go there yet. There's an interlude. And this is the meditation. And this is why we call it the meditation, because she is meditating on the words of Atanael. And at the end of this meditation, she makes the choice to leave her life in Alexandria. So it is the story of her working through all of what Atanael has said, all of the feelings she's had. She even says, unprompted by Atanael, I mean, Atanael is hitting her right where it matters, because at the beginning of the second act, she sings an aria all by herself, a monologue, how she feels that her life is empty and she is losing her beauty. She's aging and, you know, she's telling her, she's talking to her mirror and saying, tell me that I'm beautiful. And so she's already primed for Atanael's message, because she's feeling the emptiness and potential loss of this successful life that she's made for herself as a courtesan in Alexandria.
I keep talking about it as a violin melody, of course, because I've had the same, it's had the same impact on me that it has everyone else. That's the way I hear it. It's the
thing
I think
about. Well, you're married to a violinist.
I am indeed. So when I Google it in my head, it's a violin thing, but how is it rendered in the opera itself? It's an aria?
It's actually a violin solo.
So it is a violin in the opera as well. Yeah.
Accompanied by the full orchestra. And then there's some actual choral humming or ooing, or I don't know what vowel they've settled on, but from backstage. So there's a little bit of a choral texture in there, but it is a big solo for our concertmaster, Madeline Adkins. And I suspect, I can't imagine. I mean, she's played that piece all her life, and this is probably her first chance to play it in context.
That context, I'm sure, is going to change it for her, because it's usually a stand-up concert piece that happens over the course of 5 minutes on any kind of different program. And now it's actually embedded in the center of this three-act
drama. Right, and it has
drama.
A whole meaning. I mean, and because
it's a conversion, right? It's the conversion moment.
Because the last time I played it was at a wedding of a friend of mine, a violinist friend, and her teacher and I played it. And obviously, the context was very different. It was just a beautiful meditative moment to share a piece that the bride loved and wanted to have as part of her ceremony. But if you throw that other extra little bit in there, it's kind of not as neat of a wedding piece as you might think.
Definitely not.
Have you ever played it on the horn? Because I know
I have.
It's been arranged for every possible instrument.
I'm sure there is a banjo version of this.
Oh, I'm going to actually Google, what's that, Clara? What's her name? She's the theremin virtuoso from the mid-century, last century. I bet she's played it.
A theremin version of meditation. Messiaen would have loved that. Carol, let's talk about Massenet himself, because not only are his operas not well-known, he's not well-known. People know the meditation from Thais, but if you ask them who wrote it, I wonder how many could actually say without looking it up. So what's his story? What's his history?
Well, he was born to a very middle-class family in France. His dad was a foundry manager or owner, you know, so it was steelworking. And his mother was a musician and taught him his first piano lessons. And I think this is, you know, the time when we start to see music being a real part of the middle class, you know, like an educated middle class household in the 19th century and well into the 20th century, less so now, always had a piano. And so Massenet started to study piano, and he actually ended up, the family moved to Paris. He was admitted into the Paris Conservatoire. He did all of the things that every composer, successful French composer of the 19th century did. He won the Prix de Rome, which was a bursary to go study in Italy for 3 years. And if you find a famous French composer, you can probably find that they were an awardee of the Prix de Rome. But he wasn't super immediately successful. In fact, when he came back from the Prix de Rome studies, he was teaching piano and still working on his compositional craft. He also got to know opera because he played in pit orchestras as a percussionist. So he was a percussionist. He had this idea too. Church music and the organ was a huge part of 19th century French music. And so at some point he thought he should do that path and become one of the many famous French organists, but he wasn't gifted enough at that instrument. So found his way to composition, studied with Amboise Thomas who is the composer of the very famous operas Mignon and Amelie, Hamlet, which I'm sure everybody listening has heard many, many excerpts from. I'm kidding, by the way.
I think it's interesting that he seems to have had kind of an uphill fight to get the kind of recognition he deserved. You dug up this great quote that was written about his first opera, and it's from a review in the
this
Times.
This is Le Roi de Lahore.
Exactly, exactly.
The King of Lahore.
Exactly. And the quote of the review that I'm going to read now is pretty telling about what was thought of him as a composer at the time. Quote, "Although not the work of a genius proper, it is one of more than common merit and contains all the element of at least temporary success." I mean, I can't think of fainter praise than that. I mean, how do you fight through that and have a catalog as big as this? Because I know you feel like there's a lot of his operas that we should know as well as we know Menon.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing because his output ended up being quite large. He's written about 30 operas, most of which enjoyed some amount of success. I think that probably a parallel might be a musical theater piece that's premiered, you know, in the last 5 years, and I won't try to come up with one because I'll offend somebody, that is successful or has all the trappings of a wonderful musical, or it has a great production, but maybe the music is not, you know, 10 years down the road, it doesn't feel as memorable. Whereas, like, for instance, Hamilton was a groundbreaking musical that really changed a lot of Broadway. And so Hamilton's going to stick with us in the musical canon. I think that's kind of what happened to Massenet, is his music was attractive. It's never not pretty. It's always charming. It's kind of like a macaron. You know, it's tasty, it's wonderful, and it's also sort of fleeting, ephemeral.
Yeah, ephemeral, yeah.
So I think that that's what you can see, and that's the outward trappings of Massenet's music. And so it takes a little bit of effort to see beyond that and see that, you know, he really was a man of the theater who understand drama. He was a wonderful orchestrator. There's a lot of interesting color in his music. And my favorite opera of his, and I can't say that I know a ton of them. I mean, I've seen Manon, I've seen Werther. I'm working on Thaïs now, which I love. But is Cendrillon, which is Cinderella. And it's magical from the first note to the end, the final, you know, curtain. It's just so stunning, stunningly orchestrated, so clever, so witty. It's, I mean, he's a composer of the Belle Époque, and the Belle Époque was about grandeur and the Gilded Age, the TV show on Max, you know, is that same thing. The Belle Époque in France was the Gilded Age in the States, in New York in particular. And so it's just, I think it's trying to, we have to remember that there's more to it than the outward beauty. And that's what's fun about the team that we have, is they've really looked into deeper, the team of the cast, the director, the conductor, everyone has looked deeper into the piece beyond the beauty of the meditation and the pretty things that the soprano is singing, et cetera.
And to position this on a grand calendar, the Belle Époque, the Gilded Age, is, in my opinion, the moment right before the 20th century truly began with World War
Right.
I. Yeah.
It's after Prussian, the Franco-Prussian War. There
right.
was this period of peace and prosperity.
Right.
And everybody was happy.
Yep.
And then World War I.
Exactly. If you agree with me that the 20th century really began in 1914, then that time just before is what Carol's referring to. So you just mentioned Menon, Werther, Cendrillon. Is that a good playlist for people who want to learn more about Massenet?
Yeah, those are
in addition to Thaïs.
Right, of course. That's a really good start. I mean, if you beyond that, you start getting it starts getting to be a deep dive. Esclarmonde, Le Cid, Hérodiade might be interesting to people because they know the story. Hérodiade means is Herodias, and it's the story of Salome.
Right.
It's not quite as edgy and
lurid.
Lurid, that's the word, as the Oscar Wilde, Richard Strauss version that was from 1913. But still, that might be a story that people understand of John the Baptist. And it's the same thing if you think about it. It's a religious man who is standing against a sinful woman. Not really the most feminist take on.
No, but highly operatic.
But yeah, it's very operatic. In fact, we talked about whether we were going to go this direction. Menon is the same thing. She's an innocent young girl, but then she becomes a courtesan because she realizes she could have pretty things if she's a courtesan. And then her true love becomes a priest and he's tortured by the loss of this love. So it's a theme.
It's a completely different topic for another show, probably, but you and I were talking off mic about my opinion that religion and opera is largely used as a vehicle for interrogating the morality of women. And I think there's a lot we could dig into with that. Maybe someday we will, but back to Thais for just a second. You have a fantastic anecdote about the premiere of Thais, which was 1894, March 16th. It was at the Garnier, and Sybil Sanderson was the lead. She played Thais, and something happened, didn't it, that has resonances even into today?
Well, and let me go back a little bit and say Sybil Sanderson was an American socialite. She and when her father was a major legal presence in California, and when he passed away, her mother and she and her sisters all went to Paris and lived this socialite life. And she had vocal talent, and so she found a place on Paris stages. Massenet heard her, adopted her as his favorite Manon, wrote Esclarmonde for her, and then wrote Thais for her as a feature. So she was very important to him, and then she died at a kind of tragically young age, so we never got there. But Sybil Sanderson, along with someone else whose name shares two initial consonants, had a wardrobe malfunctioned. And I'm using air quotes because it's not sure if it was planned or not planned, but there is this sort of striptease moment in Thais. And audiences, please don't fear. We're not going to show you anything that you shouldn't see on the Utah Opera stage. It's always going to be PG-13 or G, you know, if it's Little Prince. But her top came off and she did the rest of the act topless, which was a huge scandal. And of course, it was the Janet Jackson move before Janet Jackson did it, and then at the Super Bowl. And you remember there was conversation about that. Was that accidental or not?
Exactly.
You know, there was some speculation that she had done it for notoriety. And certainly that's the same feeling about Sybil Sanderson, that she did it just to make a stir in the audience.
Well, was there, like in the Janet Jackson case, in Sybil Sanderson's case, was there a Justin Timberlake to blame it on back then? Or was it something that happened?
I don't know. Maybe
help?
It was maybe her leading man, Atanael, the monk, got a little bit monkey.
Well, depending on when it happened, he might have been changing his mind about his opinions.
No, I think it was actually kind of early on in the opera, so he wasn't there yet.
Okay, so as I mentioned, Carol, Utah Opera is presenting this May 4th through 12th, 5 performances, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the cast. Are there returning champions? We always like to mention those names. Are there new folks? Are there other city collaborations that are worth talking about? Tell us about the production.
Yeah, we are so excited about all of the aspects of this show. And we are generally on board in that way with every production that we're doing. But this one's particularly exciting. First of all, we were able to re-engage the entire cast that we had lined up in 2020, with the exception of the conductor who was engaged, who has since passed away. And so Stephen White is our wonderful conductor. He's been with us a couple of times already. Everybody's a returner except for the director. The director is an Italian director by the name of Andrea Cigni. He mounted this production initially at Minnesota Opera, and we're using the same physical production that was used at that time. One of the biggest issues with mounting Thais is you have to have Thais and an Atanael. You have to have a powerhouse soprano and baritone, and then you have to have a very strong tenor. He's only in 2 acts, but he's very important. So to fill in those roles, we have brought in Dominic Chenis, who was a resident artist with us years ago. He came back I shouldn't say years ago. It makes him sound like he's 85. a few years ago. And he's been back since as Don José. So he's gone into this more dramatic repertoire. And so he's our wonderful Nicias. Troy Cook is another returning artist. We've seen him in all sorts of ways, but he was in Silent Night as the Scottish priest in that story. So he's played dramatic roles, but he's also was Dr. Falca in Fledermaus. So he does the whole gamut from serious serious to comic. And in fact, I think one of the next things he does is the Major General in Pirates of Penzance, but he's doing Atanael, which is the anti-Major General.
Certainly.
I mean, it's so dramatic. Atanael, I mean, we just keep joking. He never shuts up because he's just on stage the whole time and he's pontificating and singing dramatically. And so one of the things for all of these people is learning the pacing, because this is not a role that they've probably done 47 times. It's not Musetta. It's not, you know, Troy was saying that he could do a Marcello and wake up in the middle of the night and sing Marcello. He's done it so many times, he knows how it's paced. But this may be some of their only shot at doing Thais because of how rarely it gets done. So Troy is negotiating that demanding role of Ataniel, and then you have to have the diva of all divas. And I mean that in the sense of being a goddess with a talent, not being a difficult person to work with.
Right.
I mean that in that elevated stance. She sings on her deathbed, she sings two high Ds after she's been on stage for, 2.5 hours, and she's on her deathbed, she sings a high D like you do.
What's closer to heaven than a high D?
Well, it's true. The next step is the pearly gates.
Absolutely.
So you have to have a soprano who has the charisma to carry the show, to make you believe that the entire population of Alexandria is obsessed with her, that she has the charisma to convince you that a man, a devout man of God, would turn and change everything he believes for her. And we have that person in the form of one of my dearest and most long-term friends in the opera world, and that's Nicole Heaston. She is an extraordinary soprano. We were in the Houston Grand Opera program together, and she was singing much lighter lyric roles. She was singing Susanna. She was singing Zerlina. That was her Met debut. But in the ensuing time, she's graduated to these bigger roles. She was last with us as the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro in 2016. And so we are thrilled that Troy, Dominic, and Nicole are able to be back with us, because we had the perfect cast assembled and we didn't want to have to change anything. And it's just, I can't even imagine a better cast.
I love when that happens with sopranos, when they start out, they're soubrettes, and then they become more dramatic as they get more mature and more experienced. I just think it's fantastic. And Nicole is a star. She can do all the things you just said are required of this role.
And then one of the really exciting partnership, I love when we can partner with one of our fellow organizations here in Utah, because there are so many vibrant arts groups presenting things, visual arts, performing arts, whatever. There's so much. And so to be able to join with the Repertory Dance Theater and present their artists on stage as the ballet portion, French opera is synonymous with ballet in the 19th century. Massenet uses less than the grand opera composers earlier in the century, but RDT is amazing, and they add so much to, well, you have these musical interludes. We could sit and look at pretty lighting, which I love lighting, and we will have that, but how much more exciting to be able to see these dancers that help tell the story and advance the story. And so we'll see them throughout.
The first thing that pops into my head when I think of French opera is, of course, ballet, because it's such an important feature. And I'm so glad Utah Opera is.
And it has been from the time of Lully and Rameau.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, like I said before, 5 performances starting on May 4th, May 4th, 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th at the Capitol Theater. You can go to utahopera.org for information about this. You can read all the great stuff Carol's written about it and get your tickets there. Carol, what else do we have to say? What's the closing word on Thais?
The word on Thais is, this is something that opera companies, you've said this phrase before, that Utah Opera and Utah Symphony punch above their weight at times.
Yep.
This is one of those moments where we're putting on an opera that is a daunting task for the Metropolitan Opera to do. And I think if you can't make it, when you can't make it to New York or Chicago to see this is the show that you need to see. If you loved Turandot in 2013 and the spectacle of that show, this is the show you need to see. It's extraordinary. It's beautiful. And it's a musical gift. And with the symphony in the pit, it's going to be unmatched.
Seize this opportunity. Seize this opportunity. You won't get many others in America, at least
Carpe
not right
opera.
Now. Yeah, Carpe Opera. I love it.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening today. If you haven't yet, it would really help us if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. This helps us to get new listeners. For questions about the show or to suggest a topic, you can reach us at ghostlight@usuo.org. As Jeff said, be sure to visit usuo.org for information about upcoming performances and to get your tickets to see this not-to-be-missed performance of Thais. As Jeff mentioned, be sure to visit usuo.org for information about upcoming performances, including these not-to-be-missed presentations of Thais. We hope to see you soon at the Capitol Theater or Bravenel Hall for a live performance. Until next time, I'm Carol Anderson.
And I'm Jeff Counts. Thank you so much for being with us.
The Ghostlight Podcast is produced and edited by Robert Bedont. The Utah Symphony Utah Opera season sponsor is the George S. and Dolores Dore Eccles Foundation.